From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Robin Young. This is Here and Now, and more whispers today of a major staff shakeup at the White House. It is reportedly only a matter of time before National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster will be asked to leave President Trump's inner circle. And there are questions about how long Chief of Staff John Kelly will stay.
This latest White House churn comes as tensions rise with Russia and there are moves to resume diplomacy with North Korea. Let's get to all of that with Brian Bennett, White House correspondent for the LA Times. He joins us. Hi, Brian.
Hi, guys.
Hey.
And let's listen here to President Trump yesterday on these rumored staffing changes at the White House just 2 days after he fired the Secretary of State Rex Tillerson on Twitter.
There'll always be change, and I think you want to see change. And I want to also see different ideas. Larry Kudlow just came in.
Brian, we're also now hearing that H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, could be next. Even Chief of Staff John Kelly. What are you hearing?
So right now, there's a lot of discussions inside the White House about exactly who to bring in. Obviously, President Trump pretty abruptly decided to bring Larry Kudlow on. Without a whole lot of vetting and discussion with his staff and announced that on Twitter himself. He did the same with Tillerson's departure. And so there's a lot of unease. I think on the McMaster question for Trump's national security advisor, I think talking to White House officials that Trump has decided he wants to replace McMaster but hasn't decided on exactly when or who to replace him with. So he's been in discussions for weeks with a few people, including John Bolton and some others. And I think there's some concern that if McMaster goes now, it might be disruptive at this current moment where Trump is facing two critical decisions on the Iran nuclear deal and also potential meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
But then, and let me bring in Shannon Pettypiece, who's also with us, White House correspondent for Bloomberg. Why put this story out there if you're not ready to replace the person that you are saying is going to be fired?
Well, it's not necessarily an intentional leap, but go ahead, Shannon.
Oh, I mean, I was just going to say the White House really, though, has been trying to take the temperature down on this story. I mean, sometimes the president comes out with this tweet, he'll call something fake news. But, you know, Sarah actually came out with a statement this morning saying that there are no plans to currently replace him. Though, I mean, our reporting has indicated, I think that there might be the nuance here about is he being replaced today versus is he being replaced 2 months from now. And our reporting has indicated that longer term, and I can't even really define what longer term means, but that there is thinking longer term about McMaster's future and it not being as national security advisor, let's say a year from now. But it being somewhere else in the military where he could get that fourth star. So the White House is trying to take the temperature down on this story, though. And at least our reporting indicates that this might not be as imminent as it seemed this morning.
Brian, you mentioned all of these really important deadlines that are coming for the White House, North Korea being just one of them. But what does this constant revolving door mean for the way that business gets done at the White House?
Well, it's been chaotic for a year, and it means more disruption and more chaos as people move out the door. I mean, I think one thing that may align the cabinet a little bit more in Trump's interests is moving Tillerson out and putting Pompeo into the Secretary of State position. There has been tension between Tillerson and Trump because Tillerson's been slow-walking options and pushing back against some of Trump's policies like the Iran deal or the move of the Israel embassy to Jerusalem. And by bringing in someone like Pompeo, who had a stable hand at the CIA but is ideologically much more closely aligned with Trump's objectives on Iran, for example, then that could maybe calm some waters and bring the White House and the State Department closer than it was when Rex Tillerson was running it. So we could see some of these moves try to align Trump's cabinet more with the things that he promised to do on the campaign trail.
When reporters have looked at who might be next on the chopping block at the White House, there are so many options. Housing Secretary Ben Carson, who's been in trouble for ordering expensive office furniture, and Veterans Secretary David Shulkin for taking his wife on trips to go to Wimbledon, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt for his first-class travel, the Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke for expensive new office doors, and, of course, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos after that 60 Minutes interview last weekend. Shannon, What do you make of that, that there are so many members of the cabinet that have gotten into trouble in the press and that President Trump apparently is not happy with?
Well, this is the guidance I remember being given during the Tom Price scandal.
The Health and Human Services Secretary, right, who left.
It was taking right. Private jets.
Right.
That if the president likes you and you are getting things done that he wants you to get done, he is willing to overlook certain things. If you were already on his short list, if you were not, he didn't feel like you were getting things done, he wasn't communicating with you well, he didn't feel like he had a good rapport with you, and then some piece of bad news or scandal comes out, you're much more likely to be taken
out. But that list was extremely long, and the president, you know, not that long ago said his cabinet was a shining jewel, that he was incredibly proud of it.
And when you look at, I mean, the thing that's baffled me out of all this is that Jeff Sessions is still here. But that goes back to this point that he might have some issues with Jeff Sessions, but Jeff Sessions is doing more, arguably, than anyone else in this cabinet to get his agenda done on immigrants, on crime, on drugs. So if you are getting things done for him, he'll overlook a lot of the controversy. But when either in the case of Tillerson, he feels like you don't have his back, you're second guessing his judgment, and then there's a little scandal or controversy around you, you're more likely to get thrown off the island in that sort of situation than if you're actually achieving his agenda and not going behind his back and second guessing him.
Since you mentioned Jeff Sessions, let's get to the Russia investigation. The FBI special counsel Robert Mueller subpoenaed the Trump Organization for documents pertaining to its business with Russia. Trump has said that the special counsel would cross a red line if the investigation reached beyond Russia to Trump family finances. Brian, what's your sense? Is the investigation crossing that line?
We're going to have to see how this plays out. If Trump is willing to ignite, you know, let yet another fire around his administration by pushing to clamp down on the Mueller investigation. I mean, that's definitely been a source of tension between him and Jeff Sessions, obviously, who recused himself from that. I mean, I think it's very interesting to see the intelligence officials in the Trump administration push for more sanctions against Russia, which closely align themselves with the Mueller indictments against Russians who were involved in meddling in the U.S. election. That puts a lot of pressure on Trump to finally admit that Russia was involved in meddling in the election, and it's going to be interesting to see how that tension plays out.
Shannon, why issue a subpoena for those documents? He could have just asked for them. Does it say something about what Mueller is thinking and the direction he's going?
Well, I don't know for certain why he issued that subpoena, but when I've talked to lawyers about this, there is a thinking that the Trump Organization has said all along that they've been turning over documents, that they've been cooperating, that they have been there has been a back and forth between the Trump Organization and Mueller. And it would not be surprising if, yes, Mueller had been asking all along for documents from the Trump Organization. And if it's particularly related to Russia, that would be within Mueller's mandate. If he was looking at anything related to Trump Tower Moscow, the issue of the red line, the lawyers had said, is if you get outside this purview of Russia, if you're asking about a sale of a mansion in 2007 or something that they feel is not related to Russia. And we don't know the exact wording of the subpoena. But there is one idea which we saw with the campaign. The campaign had turned over tens of, if not hundreds of thousands of documents to Mueller's team. And yet they still got a subpoena. This was a few months back. And the thinking then by prosecutors who've done this before, sometimes even if someone is cooperating, you issue what they call a cleanup subpoena that goes out and just tries to make sure all the loose ends are tied up and everything is in a package. That's one theory, at least that I've heard, that could explain this. The other, of course, is they weren't being cooperative and Mueller felt like he had to pull out the big guns with a subpoena.
Right, right.
So much has happened this week, and we're not going to be able to get to all of it. But Brian, since we have you today and you're from the LA Times, I want to ask you about President Trump's visit to California. He said California Governor Jerry Brown is doing a terrible job running that state.
The taxes are way, way out of whack. And people are going to start to move pretty soon. And if you don't have safety, meaning if you don't have this kind of wall, the drugs are pouring through in California. Can't do it.
And California leaders have already come out and said, wait a minute, we have the sixth largest economy in the world. What are you talking about? How does that play? And does it matter for California if the president is so seemingly anti-California?
Well, certainly in Southern California, people were obsessed with his visit. I was with the president on Air Force One going to California and coming back and spent the day following him around Southern California. And he really went there to do political combat. I mean, he did not reach out to lawmakers or have meetings with many Californians outside of law enforcement or supporters at a fundraiser. And then, of course, he went – his first stop in California was to go to see the 8 wall prototypes outside of San Diego, which is a really contentious issue in the state, immediately insulted the governor and Californians. So it was not a moment where he tried to reach out to people who didn't vote for him. Let's say that.
That's Brian Bennett, White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and Shannon Pettypiece, White House correspondent for Bloomberg. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Hey, good to be on.
Out in paperback this month, a provocative book from venture capitalist Bruce Cannon Gibney. Gibney helped fund PayPal, Facebook, Airbnb, and SpaceX. He's in his late 30s and is taking aim at the baby boomer generation. He began looking into why American technology wasn't improving as fast as it did in the 50s and why the Great Recession was lasting so long, and his research led him to the boomers and the economic and political policies they put in place over the past few decades. Bruce Cannon Gibney's book is called A Generation of Sociopaths, How the Baby Boomers Betrayed America. I spoke with him when it was first published. And I want to just read you first just a line from your introduction here. You say, for the past several decades, the nation has been run by people who present personally and politically the full sociopathic pathology: deceit, selfishness, imprudence, remorselessness, hostility, the works. These people are the baby boomers, the vast and strange generation born between 1940 and 1964, and the society they created does not work very well. So explain. Why do you say that? Why do you call them sociopaths?
So the reason why I call them sociopaths is because as a generation, as individuals, they are like every group, a mixed bag. But as a generation, they display the classic clinical indicators of antisocial personalities disorder, which used to be known in a less PC way as sociopathy. So, for example, improvidence is a key sociopathic indicator, and we can see that in the national data based on cohort savings levels and national savings levels, which have been in significant decline since the 1970s when the boomers first entered the workforce. We can also see it in the national debt, which on a gross basis was just under 35% of GDP when I was born, and is now at 105% of GDP and projected to exceed its World War II levels. That's about as improvident as you can get.
You blame that on the boomers. Why?
It is the boomers as political actors who presided over the policies that allowed the national debt to become so large. So in the 1970s, there was actually a great deal of hand-wringing over this sort of catastrophic level of debt, 35% of GDP. And 40 years on, the problem is substantially worse, and there's no discussion of the debt whatsoever. In fact, there were no discussions of any long-term problems, problems that were of greatest moment to the young during the course of the election of 2016. And the two candidates, both of whom were boomers, agreed on absolutely nothing, not even where to stand on the stage, save for one thing, and that was an unshakable commitment to senior entitlements.
And why do you think that is? Why do you think that this generation is uninterested in preparing for future generations and is so interested in itself?
One of the key indicators for sociopathy is a lack of empathy. So you just don't care for people other than yourselves. So in the case of Social Security, the Social Security Administration projects the trust fund will be depleted in 2034. But by 2034, the median boomer will be dead, and the same sort of dynamic applies to the national debt, which will reach crisis levels in the next 20 years. And the same logic applies to, or lack thereof, applies to climate, which is a problem whose most significant impacts are expected from the late 2030s on, but any cost of remediation must be borne today and would therefore imperil the entitlements budget. So They're deeply focused on maximizing consumption now without regard to problems that are going to be post-mortem.
But I guess my question is, what made them this way? I mean, in this book, you go back to the very beginning of the boomer generation and say that one thing that was different for them was that they spent a lot more time watching TV, and still do, than other generations.
They were the first generation to be raised permissively. Dr. Spock's book came out in 1946. So did the first mass-produced television from RCA. And the boomers were extremely high consumers of TV. There were some other odd aspects of their upbringing, including exposure to relatively high levels of environmental lead. It was the only generation where bottle feeding was a majoritarian practice. But I think one of the other critical factors was that, especially for the first two-thirds of the baby boomers, they were raised in a time of what seemed like effortless prosperity, where the economy would grow, you know, something like 3%. They would watch new stars be embroidered on the flag as Alaska and Hawaii were added to the Union. Neil Armstrong bounded on the moon. The United States more or less leapt from one great success to another. And that conditioned them to believe that success would be effortless. And I think that's had some significant impacts on the conduct of policy and personal lives.
We're speaking with Bruce Cannon Gibney, whose new book is called A Generation of Sociopaths, How the Baby Boomers Betrayed America. And Bruce Cannon Gibney, what about what happened in the 60s? We know it well, a lot of drug use, sexual liberation, and leading to an increase in divorce. This is the boomer generation.
That's right. So prior generations did not divorce frequently, in substantial part because no-fault divorce wasn't around until 69. But the odd thing is that the boomers actually have higher rates of divorce than even their children at comparable points in the marriage. So their rates of divorce are lower. And that's relevant not because divorce is a moral good or bad per se in any given situation, but because one of the key sociopathic indicators is an inability to form a lasting relationship. And I think divorce certainly falls into that category. As for the 1960s, I think it's time that we dispense with this meretricious rebranding that's gone on, that it was a time of sort of unalloyed moral victories on the part of the boomers. Curiously, it was actually people under 30, that's to say the boomers in the 1960s, who were most pro-war. And that was in part because many boomers had no real expectation that they would serve, thanks to the system of deferments. And the deferments and exemptions were, of course, the fault of prior generations. But the system of deferments shifted the burden towards the disadvantaged. I've also gotten some pushback about, well, didn't we rally for civil rights and the environment and any number of other things? But the chronology for that sort of myth of boomer goodness simply doesn't work. You know, Brown versus Board of Education was not decided by 14-year-olds, and that would have been the oldest boomer at the time. It was decided by nine old white men on the Supreme Court. The Clean Air Act that was passed in 1963, again, that's not a boomer victory.
Well, so would you give the boomers any victories later on when they were in positions and are in positions of power?
Certainly, there are a large number of good boomers. My argument is mainly one about deceleration. So there has been nothing equivalent to the Voting Rights Act and Civil Rights Acts of 1964 and 1965 under boomer tenure. The pace of gains has slowed. There has been stagnation in the convergence between female and male earnings. And the economy itself has slowed. And the slowing of the economy combined with fiscal imbalances perpetrates in many ways a much larger, if harder to see, injustice, and that's intergenerational injustice. So by failing to invest in the foundations of prosperity, which the boomers' parents did do in a very significant way, the boomers have consigned their children and their grandchildren to impoverished futures and also to cleaning up some of their messes, from the environment to infrastructure, to rebuilding the research and development and educational systems of the country.
So if boomers are so terrible, as you describe them, Why have they managed to stay in power for so long?
That's straightforward. There are just a lot of them. And the boomers are, from the perspective of policy, all roughly the same age, and they all care about basically the same thing. And that's maintaining the flow of government-intermediated benefits for as long as possible. But because Social Security and Medicare consume such a large fraction of the budget and will consume most of the discretionary budget over the next 20 years, if the boomers can win on this single issue, they win on every other issue. So if there's no room in the budget left over after paying out these entitlements for research and development or for funding free public higher education, something that hasn't existed since the boomers themselves were in college, or for remediating the climate, then the nation loses on all these issues, and the boomers win on the single issue that they're most concerned about, which is entitlements.
So do you think that the Generation Xers or the millennials are going to be better? Do you have hope for the future?
I do have hope. Young people do seem to embrace an empathetic agenda, up to and including supporting senior entitlements, I think in part because they've been misled about it. They're certainly much more progressive about climate change and civil rights than the boomers are. So I am hopeful, but it will be some time before they're in control. The boomers still hold 69% of the House. They're obviously in the White House for some time. And they control substantial chunks of the judiciary and the administrative state. So we are going to be living in a boomer America for some time, in part because the policies themselves will carry forward for some time.
That's Bruce Cannon Gibney, who is the author of the book A Generation of Sociopaths, How the Baby Boomers Betrayed America. Very interesting, controversial, provocative. Bruce, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Women in this country are increasingly more likely to speak out against sexual assault, and one D.C. student is taking the fight a step further by telling stories of other women who've been sexually harassed on public transportation. Carmel Delshad from member station WAMU reports, and a warning, her report does use graphic language.
Like many students, 22-year-old Margaret Robleski relies on the metro to get around the Washington region every day. She's a photojournalism student at George Washington University and commutes from her home in Maryland. But she says riding the metro often comes with an unintended consequence, sexual harassment. Last fall, she posted her latest encounter on Snapchat. As her friends weighed in, she quickly realized she wasn't alone.
That really just fueled my fire, that something really needed to be done about this issue, because I think it needs to be brought to light.
Robleski decided to grab her camera and get to work. She began a series on Instagram called I Was on the Metro When, publishing photographs of women who've been sexually harassed or assaulted on the transit system. So far, Robleski has interviewed about 14 women who faced anything from catcalling to public masturbation.
All the women that I've talked to really want to say something and want their voices heard. I don't think there's been an outlet for them to do that.
Robleski says she was inspired to act by the Me Too movement taking place nationwide. Public spaces like the metro are rife with incidents. 2 years ago, Metro commissioned a study that showed 20% of respondents faced some type of sexual harassment on regional public transportation. National statistics show a similar pattern. It took a lot of lobbying from activists to convince Metro to even begin tracking harassment on its buses and trains. Holly Curl, with the advocacy group Stop Street Harassment, remembers approaching Metro leadership alongside other groups in 2012.
The initial response we got was, one person's harassment is another person's flirting. It's not a problem on our system.
But it was a problem. Curl says within a month of that meeting, the D.C. Metro was on board with what advocates were asking for. Now, Metro has partnered with Stop Street Harassment and other groups to put up anti-harassment ads throughout the system and a webpage to report harassment. The agency is also running a revamped PSA, with Holly Curl as its voice.
Welcome to Metro. We want your experience on board our trains and buses to be safe and free of harassment of any kind.
Metro studies showed people aware of the campaigns were twice as likely to report harassment. Metro General Manager Paul Wiedefeld.
Then we start to build, you know, okay, we have a database, all right, and we can start to track that in case, you know, in case it does evolve into something, or there we see a pattern starting to develop here, we can get on top of it.
Critics of Metro's approach aren't sure reporting will amount to anything, especially in cases where the harassment may not be against the law, like verbal comments. And while there's still more work to be done, Holly Curl says she believes Metro is doing what it can to tackle the issue.
Sexual harassment is a rampant problem in all arenas of our life, so it would be unrealistic to expect one transit agency to solve it. We have to address the culture and change it.
That kind of change may not happen overnight, but Curl says this moment is the most promising she's seen in a long time. For NPR News, I'm Carmel Dalshad in Washington.
And at what point do you pull the plug on your favorite TV show? When The Walking Dead first premiered on AMC on Halloween night in 2010, it quickly picked up a devoted fan base. But now, well into its eighth season, some fans are wondering if it's time the show finally gets buried for good. And then there's Showtime's Homeland, which debuted in 2011. It won a Golden Globe and an Emmy for Best Drama, but critics have not been so impressed with its later seasons. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has been thinking about giving up on some of these shows, and he joins us to talk about that now. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
And spoiler alert, we're going to be talking about the plot lines in both of these shows, but let's start with The Walking Dead, a show that has not been afraid of killing off its most popular characters over the years.
Yeah, well, okay, and I'm glad you said spoiler alert, because I do not want to get emails or letters or calls from anybody. We are going to talk about what's happened on The Walking Dead and Homeland in episodes that just aired, so if you haven't seen them, just know that we're going to do that.
All right, okay. Go for it.
So talking about The Walking Dead, we had a key character actually die in the first episode back. You know, the show takes a break in the middle of its season, so the first episode that came back from its winter break, we saw Carl, the son of the hero, Rick Grimes, pass away. A really emotional scene, and I think we have some tape from it. Let's check it out.
No. No.
Carl. It should be.
I know. It's somebody you love. You can't do it yourself. I still can't.
So Carl had been bitten by a zombie, and before he turns into a zombie, somebody's got to kill him. And so he actually took a gun from his father and did it, killed himself, because nobody could bring themselves to do it. And, you know, for some people, this was sort of the last straw. The show's based on a series of graphic novels, and if you read the graphic novels, you know that Carl lives much longer than this moment in the graphic novels. And so people were surprised to see this character get killed, and they were a little angry, because in the books, this character becomes a significant, you know, character and has some great storylines that they kind of snuffed out by eliminating the character.
So are you ready to pull the plug?
Well, I'm on the verge. I think, you know, Walking Dead sometimes gets into ruts in its storytelling where it feels like it's telling the story the same way over and over again. And they also take events that really shouldn't take that long, and they use multiple episodes. So we've had this situation where the hero and his allies have been fighting the show's big villain, Negan, and they've been fighting for a long time, the whole season, and constantly these situations where there's a battle and a representative of the villain makes these speeches. They like to hear themselves talk a lot. It's great drama, but after a while you get used to it, and I just sort of feel like the show is stuck in a rut in a bit, and several people have talked about, you know, deciding to not watch the show anymore because of that, and I'm on the verge of cutting it off myself.
Yeah, I've heard from two people recently who said, you know, it's just, as you mentioned, the same thing over and over and over again. But let's go to Homeland, spy thriller. It stars Claire Danes as a CIA officer. And here's a clip from season 6 where Danes' character Carrie and a fellow agent named Peter Quinn are scoping out the president-elect's security detail. And you're going to hear a familiar sound at the beginning here.
Emmons mentioned a protest, but nothing like this.
Doesn't look like they're letting anybody through.
I'll be okay. I know her Secret Service guys.
Hey, text me when you're inside.
I will. How about you? Where are you going to be?
We'll go around back, look for that team of Deltas.
Be careful, Quinn.
You too, Gary.
So you're hearing "Not My President, Not My President." Now, the thing about this show is that it uses storylines based on real headlines to keep it fresh. But, I mean, how many years has it been now? Is it still feeling fresh to you?
Well, yeah, and again, that's a problem with Homeland. Last year, we saw them delve into these storylines involving a on-air pundit who was something like the Sean Hannitys of the world, you know, whipping people up unfairly. And this year, the story is veering into Russian led propaganda and cyber warfare, information warfare against the American president, against the American people, similar to allegations that have been made about what happened in the 2016 election. It doesn't make the show feel as fresh as you would think it does.
Really?
It makes it, to me, feel like it's a step or two behind what's happening, and I'm less interested in the show. So once again, it feels like they're going over old ground. But this show, I think Homeland feels a little fresher than The Walking Dead does, and I'm going to hang in with it.
Huh. Well, you know, sometimes people want an escape when they watch TV, and that's the reason why I stopped watching House of Cards. You know, I don't work in politics, but it just seemed like it was – you know, I needed a break from politics when I was watching TV, so I wonder if that troubles some people. But what is it, typically, that gets people to lose interest in a TV show and switch it off?
That's a tough thing to put your finger on, because there's a chemistry that happens, I think, between sort of great storytelling and characters that people care about. And often those storylines meet the moment in some kind of way. When people watched Friends or they watched Seinfeld, they had a sense that they were seeing something that was important to them, characters they wanted to be around. That's the thing that people, I think, miss most often about television, is that it's very personal. It comes into your home. You spend time with these characters. You get to know them and you form bonds with them. And I think that's one reason why people watch shows long before when the show itself gets stale and the plot lines and the storylines are not that good. If, you know, I'm invested in Rick Grimes, I'm invested in Michonne, I'm invested in Carrie on Homeland, and it's hard for me to stop watching those characters because I care about them even when I feel like the plot lines and the framework of the show has become predictable and of less quality.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
And this week, millions of people are happily watching the NCAA men's college basketball tournament that got underway last night. The women, of course, started playing today. But there are clouds hanging over this year's March Madness, allegations that some colleges used improper payments to recruit athletes. And as Quinn Kleinfelter reports from WDET in Detroit, fans of one university in particular are hoping the tournament brings a much-needed distraction.
These are the moments even casual college basketball fans and CBS sports announcers live for. A Cinderella squad or a Goliath like Michigan State in 2000, ticking off the final seconds towards a national championship.
We'll never let go of the dream.
But that Michigan State is not this year's Michigan State. Not with the university reeling from the sexual abuse scandal that sent former gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar to prison. And not after a star Michigan State player's name surfaced in a federal investigation of bribery and corruption in college basketball. Michigan State's own review found only a minor NCAA infraction, an agent's $40 dinner with the player's family. Yet by last month, Michigan State coach Tom Izzo told reporters he'd had enough.
I was not involved in this thing at all. This was our compliance people in the NCAA, and this isn't going to be the time when I'm going to answer a lot of questions. I know that's important to you. It's really not to me. We just want a championship.
That conference title put Izzo and Michigan State into their 21st consecutive NCAA tournament appearance, and fans have been quick to follow. The team has a kind of home court advantage by playing tonight in Detroit, one of the sites hosting the tourney's opening games. Even a free public practice draws fans like Roger Ludeman. He keeps the team close to his heart, literally. He has a Spartans tattoo on his chest.
The doctor, and I won't even give you his name because he's not worth mentioning, certainly made MSU a true embarrassment. But at the same token, hey, you got to play above it.
But a few rows away, longtime fan Claudia Lamb says she's not moved by critics trying to tarnish all of Michigan State.
they just want to bring down the whole school. And yes, it's awful and so forth, but that's separate from Izzo, from the teams. It's just separate. It has to be separate. Do whatever, lock them up, but don't touch our Spartan basketball and Spartan football team.
For some Michigan State fans, a chance to hoist a national trophy will cover a multitude of sins. For now. For Here and Now, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
Well, were you watching yesterday as the number 11 seed team Loyola Chicago upset number 6 seed Miami? 98-year-old Jean Dolores Schmidt was watching from the court. She's the team chaplain for Loyola Chicago and a nun, and she was asked about her reaction to the win.
Oh, thank God. Thank God you did it, because we knew we would do it. And when we were in the locker room ahead of the game, we just knew that we would do this. Our team is so great, and they don't care who makes the points as long as we win the game. And I said we want to win the big, get the big W up there, and we did.
Sister Jean reportedly prays with the team before the games and occasionally sends emails with some constructive criticism. When you dump something into the Mississippi River in Memphis, eventually it might get to New Orleans. They're waiting and watching there after Memphis decided to pump sewage water into the Mississippi temporarily over the last few days because of a pump failure at a wastewater treatment plant. Joining us now is Tom Charlier, who's a reporter at the Commercial Appeal newspaper in Memphis. Tom, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much.
And why did the plant have to pump this wastewater into the river?
Well, it was a series of electrical and mechanical failures that were related to the high water on the Mississippi River. The river was about 5 feet over flood stage, and that, coupled with the age of the plant, resulted in an electrical outage, and that resulted in these major pumps that are used to pump wastewater from the sewer interceptor up into the treatment plant becoming inoperable. And when that happened, the plant essentially shut down.
And when you say the age of the plant, how old is the plant?
A little over 40 years.
Mm-hmm. So how much wastewater went into the river?
By the time it's all said and done, they expect there will be about 300 million gallons.
Wow. Which sounds like a lot to me.
It is, and unless you look at the overall flow of the Mississippi River, which is so immense, especially above flood stage now, you've got about 11 million gallons of water moving past you every second. So it does get quite diluted. Plus, this wastewater already had been diluted because some of the rainwater and backup creek water and everything had flooded into the sewer system before it even got to the plant. So it is somewhat dilute.
How often does this happen?
Well, it's almost hopefully not going to become an annual rite of spring, but this is the second time in 3 years that we've had flooding followed by a major sewer disaster. 2 years ago, we had an even worse situation where a 96-inch interceptor basically broke when the stream bank it was flowing along collapsed and, you know, carried the pipe into the water with it, and hundreds of millions of gallons of concentrated raw sewage flowed into a harbor that is connected to the Mississippi River and resulted in a fish kill of at least 72,000 fish. That one was even more severe, and it resulted in the state came out with a fine. They proposed about a $513,000 fine against the city because of that.
How much is the city going to have to pay because of this week's situation?
It's uncertain now. I doubt it'll be as much as that because they don't know of any fish kills yet. That was part of the reasoning behind the last fine. But there definitely will be a fine, and it certainly will be in the tens of thousands of dollars. But right now, the state environmental agency overseeing this is just more concerned with getting everything fixed.
Does the blame go to the age of the infrastructure, or does it go to the fact that the Mississippi River is flooding and getting up to a higher level than it has?
Well, mostly the age, and over the years, Memphis, like a lot of cities, didn't invest adequately in its system, and in an effort to keep sewer rates low, you know, lots of cities all over the country did this. And now they have recognized in the past, several years, they've begun a very aggressive modernization and upgrade of the whole system. And they're going to be spending about $1.3 billion over the next 15 years to do things that will make these sorts of events less likely.
Who needs to be worried downriver from Memphis?
Well, anyone drawing drinking water. Our drinking water here locally comes from a deep aquifer. We don't have to worry about it directly, but New Orleans gets drinking water, and there are some other cities that get drinking water from the Mississippi. Also, in the past decade or so, the Mississippi has become more of a recreational haven. There's a lot more kayaking, paddleboarding. Some people like to camp and even swim in parts of it. It's become a lot more recreation-oriented. And for that reason, people involved in those activities would probably be well-advised to stay upstream from this.
You've been reporting on this story. Can you see the wastewater in the river, or have you been able to see it?
No, you can't really see it. The plant and the discharge area is above downtown, and it's sort of in an obscure area. The river right now just looks very swollen, carrying a lot of trees and limbs, things like that, but you can't really see it. Now, one of the things that the city has had a problem with at the sewage treatment plant, even when it's operating well, is that they've had foam that comes along with the discharge, and at certain times the foam could get very heavy. But under an EPA consent decree that was entered into back in 2012, the city agreed to make a number of upgrades, including a project that will eliminate foam at this plant just north of downtown.
That's Tom Charlier, who's a reporter at the Commercial Appeal newspaper in Memphis. Tom, thank you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.